solutions to general relativity lead to a particle picture in terms of gravitons in the quantum theory. Now, a complication compared with the electromagnetic case is the nonlinearity of the theory, as we also have already seen. So gravitational waves, of course, also carry momentum and energy, and therefore they are themselves a source of, that back reacts, if you like, on the gravitational field. Right? So there are self-interactions, and that's, of course, the same thing as saying it's a nonlinear theory. So we are, however, then looking at a simpler case, namely that of weak gravitational waves. And that's also somewhat related if you want to come up with a particle interpretation, because a particle interpretation really only makes sense kind of if your particle is kind of sufficiently away from other particles. Anyway, then this whole concept only makes sense. If you have everything kind of lumped together, then there is rather little meaning this has. So what we're doing here, we're looking, as yesterday, at the linearized weak fields that constitute then small perturbations on an otherwise flat background. Now, and what, of course, what this linearized approximation also neglects is explicitly kind of a back reaction of the geometry on the matter. So, of course, the team we knew that appeared kind of on the right-hand side of the Einstein equations when we worked out the linearized case, well, they don't know about these F mu nu's that was this linear perturbation, so they're not contained in them. And also, so what also is true, so there is no back reaction of the gravity on matter, as I've just stated, is the fact that the energy momentum tensor to that approximation satisfies del mu T mu nu equal to zero. So this is just the standard kind of flat space conservation equation. But you should note here that there is no covariant derivative appearing here. So again, this equation doesn't know about the perturbation, this F mu nu. And how this comes about is when you actually look at the linearized equations, which you derived already, so they of the form box F mu nu equal to right-hand side T mu nu. Now, if you take a single del mu of the left-hand side, then you actually see that this vanishes by virtue of a linearized version of the Bianchi identities. So therefore, you immediately are led to requiring this here for consistency. So this, and this has really, well, this incorporates the fact that, well, it doesn't feel the perturbation in the metric at all. OK, of course, what one can do and what people have done, you can, of course, say, OK, let me just start from this linearized theory. Obviously, I'm neglecting something. Can I make good for that by incorporating order by order in the perturbation back reaction? So that would then involve, in a first kind of improvement of the equation you have, adding something on the right-hand side to your team you knew that knows about kind of back reaction, it knows back of the geometry on the left-hand side, and then kind of go and do this self-consistently, order by order. And lo and behold, you can actually do this, so you can improve on this. And what you'll then find is that you're uniquely led back to Einstein's full theory, where things, so if you self-consistently try to include order by order these self-interactions, you're led back to kind of full Einstein theory. And that's, well, various people have worked on that. The one key person is Dezza. The first of these articles was written in, this was written in 1970, but it has reappeared on the archives in 2004. But don't be misled, that's an old reference. So everything then turns out to couple to the four metric, G mu nu equal. So although you just started, you know, expressing everything, re-expressing everything as a function of this linear perturbation, it turns out that all matters then in the end, after you've done this, couples to G mu nu. So that's really comes back out as a physical kind of a dynamical relevant degree of freedom. So in a way, it's reassuring that you're led back to, well, Einstein's theory this way. So there's a certain inevitability about this. Now, yesterday I ended on, you are in the middle of discussing polarizations of these weak gravitational waves. So let me just wrap up this discussion. So I introduced these unit polarization tensors. So I started writing down this E plus and E cross. These were just kind of the two directions in the space of covariant two tensors. And why I was doing it is because I want to discuss briefly what happens under spatial rotation to these polarizations. So the covariant one tensors, vectors or one forms, if you will, which are called EY and EZ in these two directions in the plane, in the polarization plane of the wave, they just rotate as you'd expect under an angle theta. So cos theta EY minus sine theta EZ, and EZ transforms to EZ prime, just a simple rotation in the two plane. Now, if you now look what happens under this rotation to this combined circular polarization tensors, which I introduced last time. I call them ER hat and EL hat. So they transform under the same transformation according to e to the minus 2i theta ER. And the one associated with the left circular polarization transforms like with the opposite angle 2 theta. So you see, it generates here, I mean, the angle is worked, so you get twice the angle here in the in these phase factors, these U1 phase factors. How they act on these rotation tensors. And well, at this stage, we invoke just a definition, namely, that characterizes how now these plane waves transform under such a rotation. So, and that makes a link to what we call the helicity of the wave. So a plane wave, that's a definition, psi transforming as phi goes to e to the I h theta phi under a rotation. Rotation by an angle theta around the axis of propagation of the wave. Propagation is said to have helicity h. So what we can just read off here is that our gravitational waves obviously have helicity plus and minus 2. Right, so here that's the helicity we've just computed. And if we had done the same for the photon, we would have ended up with an h equal to plus or minus 1. So you can just, and of course, then there is a different tensorial structure here. You don't have tensors, these things, but the analogs would just be vectors. And of course, what's the relevant thing for us? In a way that in the quantum theory, these become the states of the graviton also. OK, so which brings me to a kind of more quantum view of things, which is another way to see now how in the quantum theory this helicity appears. And that requires a little bit of discussion of the fundamental symmetry that underlies all relativistic quantum field theories. That is just the global symmetry of Poincaré Carré transformations. Okay, so let me just remind you briefly about what this is all about. So that's just part of the toolbox of standard quantum field theories on a fixed Minkowski background. That they're formulated in such a way that their actions are invariant under Poincaré transformations. Now, where do these originate? They originate, of course, as global transformations of Minkowski space onto itself that leave distances invariant, Minkowskian distances invariant, right? So that's their origin at the level of the space-time itself. So they are intimately tied to the Minkowskian flat background. So and explicitly, that's the way, one way of writing them. So a point x mu goes to point y mu, which is a linear combination of the x mu's plus possibly a translation. So I hope you are familiar with this. So these are just the Lorentz rotations or generalized rotations that just parameterize rotations in this four-dimensional space with this indefinite metric. So these are, we have here six parameters that sit in the Lorentz lambdas. So six rotations, by which I mean, of course, generalized rotations. So we have three real rotations in the spatial directions, and we have three boosts, which are rotations in planes T, I. And here we have four translations. Now, in the fact that this is a global symmetry, right, just means that I'm moving, I mean, I'm the same operation, these are constants. They don't depend themselves on x. So they just move the space in its entirety. They rotate it or boost it or shift it. Now, so underlying this is therefore kind of a symmetry group, a global symmetry group, which is 10-dimensional. And it's a non-compact Lie group. So that's a Poincaré group, which has, of course, various subgroups. So the Lorentzian rotations, for example. Now, it's uniquely, or essentially uniquely characterized by the commutators, the commutation relations of the generators of the group. has this been discussed? Do I need to write them down, the commutation relations? Is it all familiar from special relativity? Can I have some nods? Now, in the quantum theory, of course, they're still present. These symmetries are still present. And you have to discuss how they act on the fields of the theory. So of course, in general, they will, of course, act by moving the arguments x of the fields, but they will also, in general, have a non-trivial action on whatever, the vectors, the tensors that constitute just the field space of your theory. And what one can actually do, one can classify the fields according to how they behave under these Poincaré transformations. Now, and the way they are implemented in the quantum theory, where you then speak of wave functions, is that they're implemented in a unitary way. And that is just essential physical requirement that no probabilities should get lost anywhere. So that's exactly how you do implement this global symmetry. And so you have a unitary action. Say on the states of your theory, where then from state psi, quantum state is mapped by a unitary transformation, which I call capital U, which depends, of course, on the group parameters in this manner. And as I said, you can actually classify particles, and more precisely speaking, one particle states of the Hilbert space underlying this quantum field theory by how they transform under Poincaré transformations. So let me just write this down explicitly. You can classify particles now in the quantum theory. According to their transformation behavior and well, how does that work? You actually check in what irreducible unitary representation of the Poincaré group they lie. So this is the same as saying this cannot be read from the back, this bottom line, or can it? Maybe I better go to the next. So your task is to find kind of unitary irreducible representations of the Poincaré group And they're characterized essentially by two parameters, namely the mass and the spin of the particle. And just roughly sketching how this goes, I hope you have some background in representation theory. So you have the generators here, the generators of your algebra. And there, these are four generators. These are the generators of the translations. And then you have the rotations, which have these anti-symmetric, six anti-symmetric generators J mu nu. They satisfy certain commutation relations. And then you can form expressions that are quadratic in these generators that give you so-called Casimir operators. And the Casimir operators are the ones that commute with all the generators of the theory. So the eigenvalues, whatever, wherever, when you sit in a representation space and look at the eigenvalue particular state has, then if you're sitting in an irreducible state, it will have just precise, well-defined eigenvalues with respect to, in this case, two Casimir operators. And they're essentially just the mass and the spin. And now getting to the quantum theory, so the one particle states what are they in the quantum theory? So they are labeled by a p, a wave vector momentum, and some other initially unspecified parameters, which however will, this will turn out just to be the spin, right? And they're chosen as eigenvectors of this momentum operator capital P mu to start with. So they're defined to have this capital mu acting on them, P sigma. In this manner. And the way then the Poincaré transformations will act on them. So these are just the translations. So these are the unitary kind of operators I wrote down earlier. Sigma is kind of by this simple action e to the minus I a mu capital P mu. By virtue of the diagonality. And then what you do, so we have then these one particle states given, and then you can look at how these now transform under the remaining Lorentz transformations, right? So the rotations and the boosts. And then you have various cases depending on what this was. And what means the various cases, you have different, as it's called, little groups. So if you apply the Lorentz transformations on one of these one particle states, they will form, remember the discussion yesterday, something like an orbit, right? And so some of the Lorentz transformations will actually leave a given one particle state invariant. And depending on what that invariance subgroup is, that's called the little group, you get different cases. And you get to different values for the masses and the spins. Now, what is of interest for us is a particular case, of course, where the energy is larger than zero. That goes without saying. But where the mass is zero, because we're looking at gravitons. Would be the same for photons. Now, in this case, so we're interested in m squared equals zero, and p naught, that's the energy larger than zero. So that is one of the cases one gets by systematically analyzing the action of the Lorentz group. Then we are getting, we are also defining again the helicity. And this will be just the component of the total angular momentum along, well, the axis of propagation of your particle. So let me just choose that without loss of generality. Again, in one of the directions, in the three directions, say. So this is the three momentum, k, 0, 0, omega, say. And now evaluating J3, that is just this angular momentum component on k and sigma just gives me sigma k sigma. So that really comes out of kind of an abstract analysis of different unitary representations of the Poincaré group. And well, so that's a classification that goes back originally to Wigner and is a particular case of how one can discuss the representation theory of so-called semi-direct product groups, because that's what this constitutes mathematically. Okay. Now I'm erasing this, but I'm essentially going to repeat, make a similar statement now for the representations of the, I shouldn't have erased this, of the Poincaré group. Now, when you look then at how the Lorentz group acts on a given one particle state, then up to some normalization, which we will not bother about, you get the same factor e to the I sigma theta. And now, well, I'll explain this notation in a second, where theta now is kind of the effective angle that is responsible exactly for this rotation that is somewhere contained in this lambda. Right? That's what I mean by this notation. So it's kind of the theta component around the axis of propagation that is inside this lambda here. And you see that's kind of completely analogous to this the classical wave behavior I discussed before. So that was just a rotation angle about P contained in lambda. And here for this quantum case, for the massless particles, at least that's the relevant case we are discussing, the modulus of this sigma is called the spin, of course. So that was, of course, a very brief tour. And if you have, this is the first time you are confronted with this representation theoretic arguments, I understand that you're mystified. Certainly, I was for the first time mystified when I heard a particle. Oh, that's just a unitary irrep of the Poincaré representation. What? Yes. Yeah.
Representation of the unitary irrep. I'm not so sure.
depends a little bit what you do in your special relativity course.
This is quantum theory. You did it in quantum theory one course.
Okay, but what did you do? You had like the commutators written down and then discussed also the representation series or something?
No, we did the representation of the quantum variable representation.
So you derived it, so discussed it more or less along the lines in which I just sketched without writing it down with the Casimirs and how you classify it. It's a non-trivial piece of mathematics, so you know I don't blame you if you don't know it in detail. Yes.
So this is all nice and maximally symmetric space-time and everything is beautiful, but I mean if we lose some of our symmetry groups, does this whole thing kind of break down?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. But initially I already emphasized this symmetry is just tied to flat Minkowski space. There are other Well, and basically, if you have anything else as your basic underlying space-time manifold with a different metric, nothing of this goes through. There are special, of course, highly symmetric spaces, like the Zitter space, something like this. So where you can still have a group of the same dimension, which is a global isometry group of the space. Okay, and you find, for the Zitter space, people have made some progress in trying to understand, are there sensible analogs, say, of particles? And of course it boils down, like it did here, in the end, to an analysis of the representation theory of these things. Now, aside from these very, very special and highly symmetric kind of background space geometries, none of this goes through. So of course then you can already there ask yourself, well, what is a particle, right? Well, we just don't know. There is no obvious analog. And really already looking kind of at this De Sitter thing, there are ambiguities of which part of this construction you might want to find back in this slightly different context. So it's all, not very straightforward. And of course, quantum field theory on curved backgrounds will address such issues. I mean, what can you still say? What kind of operators are still well behaved? But there is certainly no straightforward particle picture. So that you definitely lose. So now, in principle, we've written down the general plane wave solutions for these weak gravitational waves. We can just put heads on everything, and we have a perturbative quantum field theory, roughly speaking. So that's a time-honored way of doing things, right? So these were just our kind of perturbative classical fields. Now, let me take a general linear superposition, right? What I'd written down were the solutions for a given wave vector k. But of course, I have plane waves. I can just arbitrarily, linearly superpose them and get kind of a general solution. So let me just do this. So I'm integrating over arbitrary wave vectors k. I normalize it in some way, which is not terribly important for now, to omega k. This is just the energy of the mode with wave factor k. I still have to sum over the helicity states. So I have to include this here in my sum, plus minus 2 in this case. Well, and then I just stick in kind of arbitrary coefficients, k sigma for my individual modes. So let me just call them d. This here are my polarization tensors, also depending on k and sigma. e to the I kx plus, in order to make this all kind of real, stick in some coefficients d star with polarization a mu nu star k sigma e to the minus I k x. Okay, and pay attention, of course, if you have different conventions for the Minkowski metric, these phase factors would change sign. So if I had colored chalk, I would use colored chalk. But now I'm just doing, you know, I go to the quantum theory, whoops, make these into operators, just as usual. So these are now, I declare as my creation and annihilation operators for these wave modes. And well, here is my, morally speaking, my perturbative free quantum field theory, right, of these oscillator states. So these are now annihilation operators creation operators of what? Well, of gravitons with a specific momentum, right, h bar k, and a specific helicity or spin state. And they obey canonical commutation relations, d hat k sigma d hat dagger k prime sigma prime, just a delta function d sigma sigma prime del 3 k minus k prime, with all other commutators vanishing as usual. So I'm just right giving you the only non-vanishing commutator. And you see, this is exactly the form in which people back in the 1930s thought of a quantum theory of gravity, starting from this weak gravitational wave picture and then just quantizing it like you would in QED. So just give you two names here of people who first published work on this. So one of them was Leon Rosenfeld, a Belgian physicist in 1930. Another one, Russian Matvey Bronstein, 1936. And quite interestingly, at least that's a claim by physicist and historian John Stachel, who who's actually written a paper about the early days of quantum gravity. Already at that time, kind of in the 1930s, I mean, people, and that's of course always kind of this amazing thing to see when you go back in time, had very similar discussions to the ones that people have about the role of quantum gravity nowadays. So for example, Rosenfeld was more or less a proponent of the school of thought that just said, well, you know, what's the problem? You know, you just go ahead like QED, you perturbatively quantize, and well, you know, what's the problem with that? Whereas Bronstein took a much more critical approach and already noted that some things were going wrong if you did things in a non-perturbative way. So he said, well, what we really should be doing, we shouldn't be quantizing this linearized theory, we should be quantizing in some way, which of course was unclear at the time, the full nonlinear theory of quantum gravity, and only then will we do justice to the theory. And then there was a third school of thought that said, well, this is all wrong. Gravity is clearly is just a macroscopic theory, and it has some underlying microscopic dynamics, which has absolutely nothing to do with these gravitational degrees of freedom. So it's just the wrong way you should just think about it. it's just existing macroscopically, and it's just the wrong way to start quantizing the theory in terms of kind of elementary, kind of gravitational quanta. Now, that brings me to the last issue I just really want to talk about, which you might ask, you know, having been confronted kind of with the standard quantization that some people, so it's a question that some people have asked, most prominently in recent days, Dyson, Freeman Dyson, as a physicist, and that's a question, how real are these gravitons? What are they, these gravitons? Are they really like photons? Can I actually detect them? Can I, in principle, and perhaps also in practice, detect individual gravitons? Is that possible? And if it's not possible, now what does that mean? What does that mean for physics? What does it mean for quantum gravity? So do gravitons actually exist? Now, what one can do, kind of also to get a rough idea of where we are kind of observationally, I've mentioned these gravitational wave detectors to you. And you could say, OK, well, the gravitational waves are coming in. Well, of course, and they're kind of superpositions of graviton states in some way. So how many, if I look at a kind of a typical gravitational wave that I hope to be measuring in one of these detectors, how close am I to having just, you know, a few gravitons? And then you just do, you know, a little, well, what you can do is you just look at kind of the classical setup, the linearized classical setup, and you look at what the energy momentum tensor is in this linearized setup. And you take a version that is kind of averaging over space and time in a suitable way. And then you compare that with the energy momentum tensor, which you kind of would naively write down just from a bunch of non-interacting particles that are moving, you know, along a given momentum. Take n of them, which have a certain energy momentum, you know, h bar, k mu. And when you do that, so for a typical, that's what you get for a typical gravitational wave. So for instance, one where the signal comes, the source is, say, a supernova, and that gets you in the region of about 1,000 hertz for the relevant frequency. And of course, it comes with a certain amplitude, I'll not bother you with. So let's look at what the kind of the graviton number density works out to. If I calculate it as I, you know, just told you, it comes out to about 3 times 10 to the 14 per cubic centimeter. So you can see you're very, very, very far away from seeing the single gravitons in our gravitational wave detectors. But of course, this is, it's kind of an interesting issue. And some people have taken the trouble of looking somewhat closer into, well, what kind of processes would involve gravitons, would generate gravitons, and how might we be able to detect them and do actually some computations. Now, most prominently in recent days, in part stimulated by this somewhat provocative statements of Dyson's, there are two people who've done this, Stephen Bone and Tony Rothman. So if you look up their names, there are various papers they've written on this, this larger issue. So looking into this somewhat quantitatively, so the first thing, so they make various statements. So firstly, they haven't found any reason in principle why one shouldn't be able to detect gravitons, a bunch of gravitons. Okay. Now, then, however, then they look into specific situations, or concretely, what observations, experiments would be relevant, and what is the size of effect I get there. And then what they find is they can concoct a highly idealized experiment. Why is it idealized? Well, it assumes a detector of 100% efficiency. So the statement there is they can, in principle, with this idealized detector, they can detect a kind of a fraction of incident gravitons, so kind of a bunch of gravitons. Now, the detector is not terribly realistic. It has to have the mass of Jupiter. So it's not something that you have on your desk anywhere. And what they then find, if they actually put in some realistic parameters for the detector, then it's completely impossible to find this bunch of gravitons. Now, they look at various other things, a somewhat older idea. Of course, you look at kind of analogs with how you detect individual photons. So if you're now asking more specifically the question, is it possible for me to kind of detect a kind of given a single graviton? So one way this might happen is just by looking at normal transitions taking place in atoms. So more specifically, a computation you can do, you can just take a hydrogen atom and just look at kind of emission, not of a photon, but of a graviton when the atom goes spontaneously from an excited state to its ground state, say. So that's a computation that people have looked at. And if you go to Steven Weinberg's 1970 wonderful book on gravitation and cosmology, you'll find it mentioned there. And he's also done a kind of simple classical minded calculation. Now, what does one find? Transition rate for hydrogen. Well, more specifically, from the 3D state to the ground state 1s via emission of a graviton. Now, what do you find for the transition rate called gamma graph? Comes out 5.7 times 10 to the minus 40 per second. Now, again, this is ridiculously small, and it's about 47 orders of magnitude away from the computation, the analogous computation you can do for the photon emission, right? So it just, this is completely ridiculous. It's totally out of the question, right? That you will, from this kind of, that in a kind of desktop experimental setup, you'll be able to say anything about gravitons. Now, they push the argument a little bit further for the detection of individual gravitons. And then they find a statement that is more, even of a more general nature. And they say, well, we've calculated two or three different cases, and we believe it holds more generally. So it turns out, if you want to build this detector for the individual graviton, then the size of that detector, and that is already kind of very generously kind of computed, always comes out as having to be smaller than the actual Schwarzschild radius of the detector. And that, of course, even in principle, impossible, because then the thing would just, collapse behind its own event horizon. So it just doesn't make any sense for a detector. So and from this they conclude, well, if that holds true, this argument, that it's even in principle impossible to detect individual gravitons. Now, and as for the deeper implications of that, I'm leaving you for the rest of the day. Thank you.